This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
3, 2, 1.
What's hot in the strip clubs? Your hosts, the 2016 and 2017 recipients of the Exotic Dancer Publications DJ of the Year Award, Danny Myers and Alon Fong.
Welcome to Behind the Curtain, a What's Hot in the Strip Clubs podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network, found on all major streaming platforms, or you can go to our website, www.whatshotitsc.com. I'm your host, Alon Fong, and you know, normally Behind the Curtains is about the strip club industry and people associated with the strip club industry and the talents and the interesting stories of their lives. Today is a very, very special episode. Here's why. Okay. For those of you who listen to the show, you know I am a Van Halen fanatic. Van Halen's what got me started on my musical journey. At 8 years old, my older sister had a record player in her room, and I remember her listening to Van Halen 1. I didn't know that's what it was called at the time. I just heard the intro to Running with the Devil, and my eight-year-old ears went, "What is that?" Sneak in a room and I would go put this record on, and I saw the images of Eddie and Dave doing splits and like all this craziness going on. And then you listen to the sound, and then Eruption came on and my mind was blown. It was over for me. Music suddenly meant something to me, right? So today's episode is very special to me personally, and I have a feeling a lot of you, because there's 1.5 million Van Halen fans out there, way more than that. I'm going to talk to Stephen Rosen, the author of Tone Chaser. What is Tone Chaser, you ask? Let me tell you, this book is incredible. A little bit about Stephen. Stephen is a former rock journalist, author. He's written for Guitar World, Guitar Player. He's written books about, oh my goodness, Prince, Jeff Beck, Bruce Springsteen, Black Sabbath. He's interviewed and done stories on Led Zeppelin, ZZ Top, The Who, Deep Purple, Lenny Kravitz, Alice Cooper, and of course, the mighty Van Halen. More specifically, he has befriended over a 25 to 30 year period and interviewed Eddie Van Halen, and gotten to know him on a level that very few people got to do. And the book Tone Chaser is about Eddie's life and how he created his sound. I think the quote I read in Brad Tolinsky's book, Eruption, was that Eddie said, "Yeah, I'm a tone chaser." And I think he said it to you. That's how he takes what he hears in his head, delivered by the universe, and tries to put it on tape and deliver it to the world, right? So this is where we're starting with. Stephen Rosen, welcome to the show. You are a very accomplished author and a reporter and journalist, and obviously are great at developing relationships with people to the point where they open up to you and making them feel comfortable. So a couple questions for you. Let's talk about you. Were you a musician? Are you a musician as well?
I am a musician. Actually, Elon, that was like everybody else. I wanted to be a guitar player in a rock and roll band, playing when I was much younger, and actually grew up listening. Actually, like the Ventures and hearing, the Reverb and Strats, and thinking this is amazing, and had bands through high school, continued on, got a little bit more into my songwriting. I was a good guitar player back in the day. I wasn't great. I mean, I wasn't like any of these guys I would ultimately interview, but I was good, and I thought I was a pretty good songwriter. And, doors would open a little bit and, you couldn't quite walk through the door, And so when I actually started, writing, doing the music journalism thing. I mean, one, I love to write. I love music. I was listening to a lot of music. I was playing guitar. I wanted to write for magazines, but I also thought maybe in the back of my mind as a way to walk through that door. And now I'm sitting in a room with the publicist for Aerosmith and Peter Frampton, or I'm sitting there with the management for Guess Who or Heart, you know. So I'm thinking, my God, I'm this close. Well, guys, listen, I also play guitar and I'm a songwriter, you know. And man, it's that thing that those who can't teach,
got it,
which is an unfair kind of a maxim, you know, but I guess they looked at me like, well, you're such a great guitar player. Why are you here interviewing our band? To make a long story short, yes, man, I play guitar. I was good. I wasn't great, but I understood what was behind the guitar playing, and I could understand songwriting and orchestration. So I was able to talk to guitar players on that level. I'm not a technical guy at all, man. You know, somebody says, well, what kind of pickups did Ed have in his, the first Bumblebee? It's like, I don't know, man. Seymour Duncan, you know, that stuff. I leave that to books like we're talking earlier about the Brad Tulinski's book. You know, those guys know that stuff backwards and forwards. That's not my thing. I knew enough. I knew more than enough to sort of talk to these guitar players one-on-one. And I think they felt comfortable with me. And you sort of, you know, touched on it earlier about opening up to me. I think I had that ability. You know, I was like the rock and roll psychologist, you know?
Yeah.
Guys would open up to me. Yeah, I don't know what that is, but I've always kind of been that person. People say, hey, man, well, can I do this? Or I've got these problems, you know? So anyway, yeah. I always play guitar, wanted to be a guitar player, could never figure out how to, one, find a band, or two, keep a band together, three, get gigs, four, earn any money, you know? But beyond that, you know, I was good. I was amazing.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. Well, you know, that empathy is a huge talent, and it's so important to be able to connect with people. I think you and I have learned over the years of interacting with these super talented artists that most of them are introverts or have a lot of trauma in their lives. And so, you know, their music is their way of connecting with the world and even their friends. And even on an intimate level, like in the closer relationships around them, they struggle with that. Right. And so I think that the skill you brought to your interviews obviously is a talent unto itself. And it's important on a human level. You know what I mean? So Tone Chaser, I heard about the book last year, and I was actually telling you about this in the pre-interview. I was a little wary about buying it initially because I figured it would be, by the name, a gearhead type of book. It's not that. So I ordered the book last night once I realized that, and I did some research. So I'm super excited to get the book and read it. But what I want to talk to you about, let's start from the beginning. Were you aware of Van Halen before you entered them, or how did you meet Eddie, and how did that sort of come about?
Well, that's a great question, man. And think about that moment and how all those little pieces came together. This is 1977, June 77. I'd been writing for about 4 years. The first Van Halen record was still 5-6 months away, February 78, the first record. The first record had not come out. Van Halen had been playing the Whiskey. They kind of graduated from like a Gazzari's, you know, they were playing like the Starwood, and then the Whiskey. The strange thing is I had never seen Van Halen play before I met Ed.
Okay.
And the reason that was so weird, man, was because I was literally at the Whiskey. Man, I'll bet you I was there three nights a week. I mean, all these bands, back in 77, a lot of these bands that are now monstrous, they were just coming out with like first and second records. If you go back just a little bit earlier, I mean, Aerosmith. My first time I interviewed Aerosmith, all five guys, they played the Whiskey, and it was half full. The first record. I mean, the first record of besides Dream On.
Yeah.
And there were just so many bands like that. Publicity companies, management wanted these interviews, man. So they were courting writers, that kind of thing. So I had invitations to the Whiskey. Literally, I could have gone every night.
Wow.
We're talking about right in the height of the punk thing. I was never a punk guy. I'm sorry. I just didn't get it, you know?
Yep.
Cheap Trick was recording a live record at the Whiskey. I thought, wow, Cheap Trick at the Whiskey. Okay. That's what's checking out. This is before Budokan. This is like, I forgot the name of the record, Live something, you know, the Whiskey. But I thought, hey, Cheap Trick at the Whiskey, that's where it's going. So I got with my brother. We drove over there. I was living in the Hollywood Hills, so the Whiskey's just literally 10 minutes away.
Yep.
So we show up there. I had befriended the girl who booked the Whiskey. Her name was Michelle Meyer. She also booked two clubs called Madame Wong's East and Madame Wong's West.
Yep.
Madame Wong's East was a pretty famous punk club. I mean, all those punk bands were playing there. And what Madame Wong's West is a little more rock-oriented. And we became friends, sort of never having heard my band. I had a band called Deluge at the time.
Nice.
She booked me into both clubs. And I would have done anything for her, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I loved her. So we're there. Cheap Trick's about to come on. She taps me and goes, "Hi, Steve." You know, she goes, "Listen, there's somebody upstairs. You need to meet him." So, okay. For Michelle to want to introduce me to somebody, it had to be somebody amazing because she knew everybody. I mean, I call her a Yenta in the book. I mean, she just, you know, her radar was fallible. So we walk upstairs, up into one of the dressing rooms, and the dressing rooms are like these trash cans, to be honest. You know, the carpets are filthy and there's graffiti on the walls, man. But it's a whiskey, you know.
I've been there, yeah.
So I see this guy standing in the corner, you know, this guy smoking cigarettes. And I'm pretty certain I recognized him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have to understand, 77, there are no stories out on Van Halen, right? There were some posters around, you know, maybe I seen a picture on a poster.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I recognized him. He walks me over and she goes, "Steve Rosen, Eddie Van Halen," you know, and I take his hand and... No, Eddie Van Halen, Steve Rosen, and then she says, you know, "Godhead" in describing Edward. And when she said "Godhead," this is like, you know, you're a creature from another planet. This is the highest praise she can dish out. And I don't think, well, I know that Ed wasn't expecting company because he was kind of standing in a corner, you know, and he was smoking and he was probably drinking a beer. So I felt a little funny walking over, but I thought, hey, this is Michelle Meyer. She knows. So I walk over and, you know, we shake hands. I said, "Hey, man, how you doing?" I knew about Van Halen's deal on Warner's.
Okay.
So I had heard about that. And I mean, they were big news in Hollywood. I mean, everybody heard of Van Halen. I had just never heard them play. I didn't know who this guy Edward Van Halen was.
Right.
Really, I didn't know how he played. So we're talking, you know, somehow the conversation comes around to like Eric Clapton. And I don't know if Ed had steered it there or I did.
Yeah.
But we start talking about Clapton, and I can see how much this guy's into Clapton. And I have to tell you, and I write about this in the book, I love Clapton.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew everything that he did. I mean, not just the Cream stuff, you know, by Dan, Derek and the Dominoes, and the Blind Faith. Yeah. But I mean, you know, the male stuff and going back to the Roosters, his early blues bands. I knew what he did, you know. So when I ever talked to somebody, the subject of Eric Clapton came up, I was always waiting for them to make some comment that told me, this guy really doesn't know shit about Eric Clapton, you know. I mean, it was like, the fickle guy in me, it's like, you're going to say that you don't know anything, you know? Yeah. Oh, Eric Clapton was in a band before his solo record. It's like, I'm done with you. Anyway, the thing about Ed is he went beyond that, man. Ed started talking about the technique and the sound and his vibra. And I thought, holy shit, this guy, he's 10 levels deeper than me. I mean, I could appreciate Eric on that level, but you know, as a musician, like, so we're talking about Eric. We talked about Beck. Blackmore came up, and it was just one of these really good conversations. If it was a girl, you wish it could have been that good, man. You know, it's like, hey, she's going to want to see me again. And so the conversation is drawn to an end, sort of, and he runs out of the room, kind of comes back, and has like a little piece of paper. He drops it on the carpet, and he picks it up. You know, he has a pen, and he says, "Hey, man, here's my number, man. I still live at home with my parents, man. Call me."
Oh, that's wild.
Wow, my God. In 4 years of interviewing guys, no one had ever given me a phone number to call them. And really, it began there. And, awesome. And people said, well, at what point did it become sort of knowing Ed and then talking to him as interviewer and interviewee and becoming friend? And when I really think about it, I really think that the seed for the friendship was kind of planted on that first meeting.
So, I was going to say, yeah, that's huge. For you to meet him before the come up, before the blow up, is so huge. I've known and met very many successful people, and they all say, you know, it's hard once you reach a certain level, even if you're like a CEO, because you're the boss, and you never know why people are befriending you. Is it because they want to move up? Is it they want your money? Do they want dirt on you? You just never know what their motives are. And so the fact that you were able to develop that relationship with Edward before all that, he had to have an intrinsic trust with you. And then over the years, obviously you prove it out through your actions.
We'll be right back with Steve Rosen, author of Tone Chaser, right after this.
This is DJ Mike D with my chum Elon Fong, right here on the What's Hot in the Strip Club podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to Behind the Curtain with Steve Rosen, author of Tone Chaser. We're going to get into a little bit about the impact of the mighty Eddie Van Halen.
You know, the other interesting thing about Eddie is, and Van Halen, but Eddie, for me, I'm not a guitarist, but he made me love guitar. So I've always now loved and followed other guitarists, but it was, to me, that's what separates him from every other guitarist. So like at the time, Randy Rhoads was the other big name. I didn't even hear of Randy until, I don't know, 4 years into me being into Van Halen in high school. Mm-hmm. One of my rival buddies or whatever was like a Randy Rhoads disciple. And he said, oh, he's way better than Eddie. And I got mad. And so we're debating. We always had this debate back and forth. And when I think about it now, the difference to me is what separated Eddie from all the other guitarists is what we've known now as his style and his technique. He lived it. It literally was him. Everyone else after that learned his techniques and then applied it to songs. He had a melodic sense, a swing, a groove, a style, a feeling in his playing that no one could replicate because it came from his soul or from the universe, as he says, right? And to me, that's what makes him the greatest guitarist of all time. All these sounds that came out of his head that he had to put down on tape, the pick screams and the wah-wah stuff, and stuff. No one had done that stuff. Look, some of the tapping, Alan Holdsworth, you can talk about where tapping started, but there's so much more to Eddie's playing than tapping. And as a non-guitarist, I learned all this stuff because all I know is to my ears, it touched me and spoke to my soul. And so to me, that's what makes Eddie Van Halen different than everybody else. His guitar playing could translate to a non-musician.
That's interesting, you know what I mean? Man. Yeah, it's a really interesting concept. That's really part and parcel of a question I've always asked myself. What was it about Edward that attracted, you know, such a following? And what you say makes a lot of sense. Edward did live and breathe the guitar. You know, I write in the book that every time I saw him, he had a guitar in his hands. But it was more than that. Without the guitar, you know, had he not been a guitar player, I don't know what he would have done. Emanated from him. And because I mean, you know, a lot of people who read the book aren't musicians. In fact, I think probably most of the people that I've at least received responses from, they're probably not players. So yeah, so they were touched in some way. Yeah, he had something really rare, really special. And your theory about other guitar players kind of learned the techniques and that, and with Ed, it just came kind of forth naturally. That's really interesting. Because, I mean, at that time, I mean, there were some other really good guitar players.
Oh, yeah. Randy's amazing. By the way, let me just say, I don't think Randy sucks or anything. Randy Rhoads is an amazing guitarist.
No, I didn't get that at all. No, I got that. Absolutely. I mean, George Lynch and Warren Martine, Red Beach a little later, you know, mm-hmm. Rusty Anderson, you know, in McCartney's band, who's a monster guitar player. But I know what you're saying. I mean, these are brilliant, brilliant musicians, but there's some X chromosome that Ed had that they didn't have, that nobody else had. I mean, maybe Hendrix had it. Mm-hmm. I interviewed Jeff Beck. Jeff was pretty freaking special. I think Jeff had some extra chromosome in him, but it's some amazing thing. Yeah, and you talk about his swing and his rhythm playing. Alex is a great drummer. Mike was a good bass player.
Yeah, he gets a bad rap, I feel like, but yeah.
And I preface all that in the book. I love Mike. You know, we kind of knew each other, but you have to understand that I came up listening to bass players, and I'm not that I'm trying to compare Mike, but my ears were tuned to bass players like Don Entwistle and Jack Bruce and Chris Squire. You know, it's just a different school. You know, what Mike did, it worked, his vocals. And we talk about that, the personality, he had to be that person. You know, Mike calls himself Switzerland. He was a neutral you know, country between the Ed and Dave. But Ed was the rhythm, was the groove of that band. It was frightening how amazing his rhythm stuff were.
Speaking of the rhythm, is interesting. So Nuno Bettencourt just said, talking about his Rise solo, you've heard about Rise on the new Extreme album and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. And he talked about how actually he was a drummer. And so he plays his guitar solos like they're drum fills. And he said he got that from Eddie a little, because Eddie started as a drummer first. And Eddie had talked about how his playing was very rhythmic, and he thought in the lines of a drummer. And then you consider the relationship and the interplay with him and Alex, where you know, Eddie has said he didn't even listen to the bass. He didn't listen to the vocals, and his monitors was just Alex. So he could feed off of that. You mentioned his rhythm playing. And again, as a relative layman, I'm not a guitarist, but I've learned, again, all this is because I loved Eddie. And so I really got into guitars. I'm a big fan of the guys you mentioned, George Lynch, Nuno Bettencourt's big, Vernon Reed, people like that. I love all those guys. But it started with Eddie. And his playing on a rhythmic level and the swing they had, the groove they had, and it's the whole band too. I think all the stupid drama over the years, the magic they caught in a bottle with Dave, the four personalities, they were all very unique and created a bigger whole. And I think that's what people forget now, looking back and looking at all the tabloid stuff and, you know, picking sides, Sammy or Dave or whatever. They're two totally different bands, first of all, to me, the Sammy era and the Dave. I don't like to compare them. They're just different bands. They're not the same band. So when you met him in 77 and then you became friends, but how often were you guys interacting? Were you already working and writing like long-term? Like, was it that a known thing, or did you just kind of pop in, or was it just per how you were hired for projects or for articles, or you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, that's a question I had to answer. You know, I tried to lay the book out chronologically. Mm-hmm. At first I was going to lay the book out, jump from, you know, 77 to 83, and then it got really confusing because I had sort of my tapes, which is my main reference point, my interview tapes. And even though a lot of those were incorrectly marked or not marked at all, basically they were in these binders in what I was a basic chronological order. So if I'd had to jump from the first tape, if that was the earliest interview, and then go find a tape from 80, it would have been impossible.
Chaos.
So I tried to lay it out chronologically. And in answer to your question, and I tried to answer this myself in the book, when was I doing the interviews and what was happening between the interviews? And a lot of those moments are difficult to recall. Certainly I can remember the interviews because those were on tape. Sometimes I had a date, sometimes I just had a year. So the first interview I did with him was December 77. This is still before the first record. Okay. So I met him in June. So a few months later, we do a phone interview. And the strange thing with Ed, and I go back to this all the time, I don't think he remembered meeting me at the whiskey. And it would happen over and over, and not because of the span of a few months, but literally it could be a span of a couple days. And I learned to think, well, you know, he had so much more up in his brain other than trying to remember, you know, our last conversation. Honestly, I think so. The first record is out February 78. You have to understand also they're on tour every year, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So he's gone for 6 months, 8 months. So there was also those kinds of lapses. We talk on the phone, you know, and some of those became phone interviews. But I would say really probably by the beginning of the second record, it became pretty regular. You know, he would show up at the house. He'd moved into Valerie's. You know, Valerie lived mm-hmm. at the Coldwater Canyon. It was her house.
Okay.
And then Ed moved in there, you know, from his parents' house, which I always found unbelievable. So he, you know, literally Mulholland is a kind of a big famous street in the Hollywood Hills. And it was literally a Mulholland 10-minute drive away between our houses. So he'd show up, or I would never go over to his place without calling. I couldn't do. So I'd call him and he'd say, yeah, what are you doing? Come over. So I think pretty early on, it became a pretty frequent thing. And honestly, as much as I try to remember, I know that even in the book, I know that there were a lot of times that I can't remember.
Sure.
Unfortunately, hanging out with them. Yeah, so that thing turned into, and we talked about it before, the the friend thing and interviewee thing. I think that, you know, really became a friendship pretty early on.
That's awesome. So, all right. Let me get to a quick break here. Hold on 1 second. Yeah. We'll be right back. Our guest today is Steve Rosen, the author of Tone Chaser, a great book about Edward Van Halen, the King. And we'll be right back with Mr. Rosen right after this.
Hey, what's happening? It's DJ Mike D, and you're listening to a What's Hot in the Strip Club podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network. Let's get it.
We are back with Steven Rosen, author of Tone Chaser, on Behind the Curtain, a What's Hot in the Strip Club podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find us on all major streaming platforms or check us out at our website, www.whatshotitsc.com. Did you get to interact with his parents at all or meet his parents?
I met his parents. I think I met his dad a couple times. His dad would come to those. They used to have these big open rehearsals, pre-production rehearsals before going on tour. And they rent out, a monster room at SIR.
Their stages are huge.
And I think I met his dad there twice. I think I met his mom once. And it was probably backstage at a gig somewhere. I don't know if I exchanged more than a few words with them. I don't want to give everything away in the book for you or anybody else who might not have gotten this far in it, but let me backtrack just a little bit, Elon. So back in 85, I am supposed to write Edward's authorized biography.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In contracts. I approach Ed. I go, Ed, listen, man, someone's going to approach you to write your biography. Right by 85, he was a monk. I said, guys are going to approach you. I would like to write the book. And he said to me, yeah, man, I can't imagine anybody else writing it but you. Humbled to my knees. So we actually signed a couple little contracts. I literally typed up one paragraph saying, I, Steve Rosen, has Edward's authorization to write his biography, blah, blah, blah. He signed it, I signed it. About a year later, 85, we went to his lawyer, and he drafted a somewhat more complex, and this is only, I think, 2 or 3 paragraphs, contract. Now, these pictures are in the book, which are pretty fun to look at.
That's awesome.
Yeah, Steven Rosen has the right. Edward Van Halen has a final say on when the book would come out, just like any artist would. I said, hey, of course. So I began working on the book, gathering interviews, friends and guys promoting shows and former musicians and everybody I could find. So back in 85, what I also needed to do more than anything was sit down with Ed and get all the interviews for the book. Look, I had done the interviews for the guitar mags, that stuff was covered. But I said, Ed, we need to sit down. I want to talk. What was it like when you were 6 years old and growing up? And, what kind of house did you live in? And what kind of car did your parents drive? And what was the relationship with your parents and your brother? And, all that unbelievable stuff. I said, Ed, I have to talk to your parents. He goes, yeah, okay, And I kept bugging him. I said, Ed, I've got to talk to your mom. He goes, well, okay. He says, but I want to be there. As if I was, that goes to this thing in him. Like he thought that I wouldn't think his presence would have been important or something.
Right.
It goes to humility. You know what I mean? For him to say that, it was just amazing. I go, Ed, of course I want to be there. My God. And he goes, I'll set that up. I go, great. And it never gets set up. I did the same thing with his dad. His dad passes away. Oh. He goes, hey, man, did you ever talk to my dad? And I got a little angry. Yeah. I go, no, man, I never did because you never set it up. And I put, and how hard do you put on somebody, whether your friend is
you got to be careful, right?
That's right. Now, something like that. Now you're irritating the guy and, hey, stay out of my life.
Right.
So those that said, right, that's gone forever.
Yeah.
Right. Alex is the only one really who could shed any light on, the relationship between Ed and his mom and his dad. And Ed does talk about his mom and dad in the book. And I don't want to talk about that because it's a pretty amazing moment.
I asked that because, based on the books I've read and what I've heard, and so I'm half Chinese, right? And I'm a first generation American. So I'm an immigrant family. And I know part of the reason I connected to him, he's got the Asian blood in him as well. And I think I connected to that visually. I'm like, he looks like me, right? And so when you hear about his introvertedness and how he was picked on at school and having to learn a different language, I at least grew up in America and was taught English from the jump. My mom is Austrian, my father is Chinese. So the common language in the house was English. And so when you hear later about his substance abuse and his drinking and all that stuff, you talk about his mom, who was sort of a tiger mom, his dad and his dad's drinking and cool stuff and all that. It really makes sense. That's why I was going to ask you, did you witness sort of some of the interactions or what that dynamic was like to try and understand Ed, the person, a little bit?
Wish I had that.
Yeah, yeah, because he's such an interesting cat, like, not just as a musician, but just as a human being. And one of my biggest regrets in life is not having ever met him or Dave. Dave, they're both my sort of, you know, musical heroes, right? So let's
Dave's get still around, man.
What's that?
Dave's still around. You never know.
Yeah, maybe one day. I know people have met him, and I've heard it's hit and miss depending on which Dave you get, right? Real quick, so let's since you did your book in eras, let's talk a little bit about the David Lee Roth era. Do you have a favorite record from that era, and what is it?
I don't know, man. The Fair Warning record is pretty insane. I mean, yes. You know, I thought Dave's thing about as well as he ever did on that record.
Yep.
Ed, you know, we now hear Ed as a real composer and orchestrating guitar parts and his solos, the sound of his guitar. My God, it's wow. That might be a first choice.
That's my favorite record. Well, by the way. And I just want to give Dave credit vocally on Push Comes to Shove. Like, his vocals on that track are amazing. He gets sort of overlooked in two areas. One is vocals, certainly in studio, were better than what people give him credit for, I feel like. And his lyrics were so unique and interesting. He rarely said something. Sammy's lyrics were very journeyman to me. They were to the point. They were very what they were, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And they were fine. But Dave's are much more creative and interesting, just to me, my opinion. And so Roth live, I think he sacrificed a lot of his vocals because he's running around and jumping around and being the showman that he was, because he could sing a little bit when he really wanted to. No one's going to mistake him for Steve Perry or Freddie Mercury. Don't get me wrong. But right. And obviously his screams and his the two-tone scream he's famous for was yeah. unique and special and whatever. Okay. So I do have a question about the whole Van Halen process as a former singer and lyricist. Who wrote the vocal melodies and hooks, and like who came up with the harmony parts and who wrote those? My understanding was that Eddie would do the music and then just turn it in to Dave, and Dave would come up with, did he do all the vocals and melodies and choruses and stuff? Or,
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I actually approached the subject a little, I reversed things into your question. I asked Ed, I go, Ed, do you ever come up with melodies mm-hmm. to a piece of music that you give to Dave? I mean, certainly when you're writing, and Ed was a singer, as we all know, you know, he sang mm-hmm. back in the day, actually sang lead on some stuff. So, you know, as he's playing, you know, just sort of subconsciously, he's going to hear some yeah. melody running through his head, you know, that maybe turned into a little guitar line or something. But he goes, no, man. And like you said, I don't even know what Dave's lyrics are. So did Dave come up with all the lyrics and the vocal melodies? I would say absolutely yes. I mean, maybe Dave, maybe Ed or Mike had, maybe they heard something. I don't even know if Ed was in the studio when Dave cut lyrics. When Dave cut melodies.
Vocals.
When Dave cut vocals, yeah, I'm sorry. In terms of harmonies, you know, Mike is a really good singer. You know, I think maybe Mike had some input there. I mean, some of the harmonies are kind of, well, this is the harmony that it's not like some intricate harmony that you wouldn't hear. But I'd say Dave had obviously a huge hand in that as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, you got to give Dave credit for all that stuff, man.
Yeah, and, okay. I always wondered that because... If that's more musical than most people give Dave credit for, you know, more musicality.
Yeah, it is. Definitely.
So when Eddie is recording now, you know, we've heard the stories of him just recording hours and hours of just bits and things. He just got to get it down on tape. He's like Prince that way. Right. You know, they both had a studio access because it was in their homes 24/7. Prince's case, he had a whole band he hired. He would just call. They'd have to show up no matter what time and be there for 8, 10, 12, 16 hours and record. Right. Were most of Eddie's stuff that complete as far as music? Maybe not vocals, but certainly instrumentation-wise, was it, you know, completed songs or was it just riffs or was it an amalgam of all the above?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, it's one of the things I wish I could have asked Ed. I can tell you that in the studio and in the house, I remember cardboard boxes that were filled to the brim with cassettes.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I mean, I don't think that they were that complete. Certainly, Ed would have maybe gone back to stuff, brought in Alex, you know, who just lived literally 5 minutes away from Ed. You know, Al come over and play some drums. Ed would have played bass. But I think most of those ideas, maybe he was playing to a drum machine.
Okay.
But I think most of that stuff was just kind of Ed noodling and ideas. There were thousands of cassettes.
Yeah.
You know, and I always see to the library, the archive. I was never in there.
Okay.
You know, with all the reel-to-reels and 2 inches and. Yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, I guess a lot of that stuff Wolf found for the Different Kind of Truth record. Those songs that he found were probably pretty well done, Yeah. I mean, I wish I could have talked to him more about that stuff.
Eddie's always, I mean, of course he wrote instrumentals, but he understood or knew and seemed to love writing songs with the context of having vocals. So everyone I know has said, you should do like a Satriani record. And he'd be like, no, man, I like playing with Alex. I am doing my own solo band. It's called Van Halen. You know what I mean? Certainly he liked vocals. And we've heard about, did you ever talk to him about between Dave and Sammy? You know, I know it was pitched to him and maybe he came up with the idea of having an all-star band record with a bunch of all-star singers. Did you ever talk to him about maybe who some of his dream singers might be or anything about that?
We had that conversation in a peripheral way. We were talking about, so there's a little bit in the book, and again, I don't want to give it away.
Sure.
Ed started wanting to play cello. And I thought, my God, can you imagine Ed playing cello and what he could do?
Whoa.
I had a buddy who was a really good cello player, also a great bass player. Anyway, I had my buddy come over to the house once, and Ed and my buddy could both drink. Anyway, they turned out a lot more drinking than playing. But so I asked Ed at an interview we had, I don't know, a few days later, perhaps, so you're playing cello. And they said, yeah, man, I'm playing sax. And I said, oh, so you're going to, something about a solo guitar. And this is an interview in Guitar World. He goes, yeah, it's going to be called Guitar. What guitar? but he also talked about, there was talk about, yeah, doing a record. Pete Townsend, who he had spoken to a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that could have been an amazing collaboration. My God, Townsend and Ed. Oh, my God. But I guess it was like a little bit of a thing about what rhythm section were they going to use. Ed thought that Pete was going to come to 5150. Pete wanted Ed to come to England. So that never manifested. Phil Collins.
Yeah, I heard
Patti
that.
Patti Smythe's name came up. A couple others.
Female vocalist. Patti Smythe, right?
Patti Smythe, yeah. There were a couple others. You know, and I mean, that could have been interesting.
Yeah.
You know, different singers. But again, it's just testimony that Ed, loved vocal music.
Yeah. And obviously his brother, I think, you know, let's talk a little bit about his relationship with Alex. Like, obviously, being an immigrant family, his big brother, you bond closer because your language skills aren't that great with English. They grow up together in a poor upbringing. So it's not, you have a bunch of resources, go do a bunch of stuff, even especially in Southern California, right? Talk about your view on the two of them, not even so much musically, but as brothers and as friends. What did you see that stuck out the most to you?
I mean, they loved each other unequivocally. And back in the day, I mean, before I knew them, they were getting some pretty massive fights. Alex told me a story. These are brother fights, right? They're not really hurting each other. Alex had a picture of Cream up on his wall, and Ed wanted the poster. Ed said, I'm going to take the poster. And Alex goes, no, you're not. He goes, yeah. So I think Ed, or was reversed. Ed had the poster, and Alex wanted. Ed, I think, cut out a little silhouette of Clapton, and they got into a big thing. But you know, you talk about Alex being the older brother. Alex was absolutely Ed's
protector.
Big time. Yeah. You know, not that he was ever menacing in your face, but you just knew. And I sensed that, you know, because Al would be over 5150. If I was there, he'd be there a few times. And I knew Al pretty well. I mean, I think it was that thing that Al sensed in me that I wasn't going to hurt Ed. And I don't mean physically. I mean,
of course not.
I wasn't going to lie or steal anything or write about him. And so Al welcomed me into the fold, as it were. But yeah, Al was definitely his protector there. And yeah, you know, again, we talk about it musically that, you know, it was always those two guys. There's a pretty interesting little thing that happened. I went on the road with Van Halen for 2 days, the Sammy era, 86. And I was up in Ed's room. This is after a concert. They just sold out Bill Lewis Arena in
Detroit.
I mean, I don't know.
That's Detroit, isn't it?
Oh, sorry, maybe Detroit.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, people went crazy and there's a knock at the door. This is like 4 a.m. So I'm up in Ed's room. Illegal things may have been going on. But,
it's rock and roll, baby.
So there's a knock, and I'm thinking, who the hell is going to knock on Ed's door at 4 a.m? Anyway, it was Al, and I'm not going to give away the rest of the story.
Okay.
But it was an amazing moment. You know, hopefully it piques some interest because it was astonishing to me. But yeah, I mean, they loved each other. They, like I said, Ed, you never play with another drummer? He goes, no, never.
Makes sense.
So I think when Ed was like a little Ed, I mean, maybe when he was jamming with seventh graders, you know, maybe another drummer would come. But
yeah,
for the most part, to the point where it got
Now, is Al a bit like, I've never met him. Al seemed like a pretty big guy, at least tall wise.
Oh, he was.
How big is he? Do you have any idea how tall he is?
Well, everybody's tall to me. Okay. I'm 5'7" if I'm standing on a mountain.
I bet is Eddie Al, short? How tall is Eddie? How much taller than
Ed's like 5'8", 5'9".
Okay.
I mean, he's not real tall, but, you know, Ed was always in, you know, unbelievable shape. I mean, Ed could certainly take care of himself. I wouldn't have wanted to wrangle with Ed, you know, because he's always so ripped and toned his fucking arms. But Al, I'd say Al was 5'10", 5'11".
Okay.
You know, I mean, not huge, but, you know, he's playing drums. I mean, he was a beefy guy. You wouldn't want to screw with Al.
And certainly not brothers, you know? Right?
Yeah. And Al was the yin to Ed's yang. Al was, I don't want to say dark, but he was just a little more inner. I mean, Ed was inner too, but Al was kind of really inner and like, you kind of knew him and turned out to be a very fun guy. And I'll just give away another little piece. I double dated Al and his girlfriend, and my girlfriend and me, we double dated one night, and it was unreal. So you got to read that chapter too.
All right. We were talking to Stephen Rosen about Eddie Van Halen, his life and times of them. We just sort of discussed the David Lee Roth era. And before we get into the Sammy era, I wanted to ask some questions about in that interim, in the space between. Look, band breakups are brutal. They're like marriages. There's a lot of personal hurt feelings involved. I know I was the one band I was in, Slam Circus. Shout out to those guys if they're listening. Love those guys. I was crushed when we broke up. I was so bummed out. And I can't imagine having gone from young men, 17, 18, to now they're on the top of the world. They're 26, 27. Arguably the biggest band in the world at the time breaks up. In between Dave and finding Sammy, you know, what was sort of his emotional mental state? You were friends with him. You were still talking to him. How must he have been feeling at the time?
I write about that fairly extensively. Ed was an unhappy soul. With Ed, it was all about respect and the way that Dave quit. Look, I mean, the truth of that, you know, situation, Dave quitting, Dave being fired, you know, lies somewhere in the middle. You know, sure. Dave has his version, Ed has his version. But basically, Dave left the band at the height of a band's career. You know, you're working, you do backyard parties and you put out flyers on Sunset Boulevard and you get there. You're so upset, unhappy that you leave the band. You can't go off and do the EP and take some time off and come back. So with Ed, that was disrespect. Ed thought that everything that he had worked for and created with Dave, he thought that Dave just tossed it away like garbage. And Ed talks about that in the book, and Ed was fucking mad. He was mad, you know. He was hurt. He was fragile. I don't think he was ever... I mean, he never came out and said, oh, my God, what am I going to do now? I mean, I don't know if a guy like that said those things. Did he feel that? I don't know, man. I never sensed that.
Okay.
But, yeah, he was unhappy. So Dave actually did the EP, and he was still in the band, right?
Okay.
So I asked Ed, you know, have you heard the EP? What do you think? He goes, yeah, man, I really like it. You know, he got the Carl Wilson to sing on California Girl, and I thought he did a good job, you know. Said, you know, in typical Van Halen fashion, I hope the fans embraced it. So Ed was all for it. You know, Dave, you want to go out and do your thing, man? That, you know, has nothing to do with Van Halen. You know, you want to do your stick and do your covers, be that guy, great. And then when Dave left, I don't think Ed was...
Felt the same.
Yeah. I don't think he was saying those same niceties. Ed, look, man, I can't blame him. I don't know. Look, I know band dynamics. You talk about what happened to you. I mean, in my little way, I was in a band and I was writing all the songs and they kicked me out because I didn't look right. And I knew it.
Yeah.
I didn't look, you know, but it's like, you fucking asshole. Don't you get it? You know, but I mean, hey, I mean, Aerosmith, my God, the Kinks, I mean, the biggest bands in the freaking world. They're still fighting with each other 50 years later. So look, man, Dave's a human being. He could do whatever he wants. I think it's just the way he did it, man. It's just like, you know, Monday he's in the band, Tuesday he's not. But Ed hurt. I mean, it hurt him a lot, you know. And we talked about, you know, the band that Dave put together, mm-hmm. you
Great
know. And Ed certainly knew who Steve Vai was, had a lot of respect for him, was friends with Billy.
Billy, yeah. Talis opened up for him.
That's exactly right. Dave might have been a lot of things, but he wasn't a stupid guy.
Yeah.
And he put together a freaking good band.
I was going to say, you know, the other thing is these bands start when they're kids. They don't have any business sense. And they, and most of them don't even have the emotional maturity to communicate and develop relationships that are healthy. So it's no wonder that they kind of end up. Then you add drugs, alcohol, fame, money, pussy, you know, it fucks up any man's mind. So my first live concert ever, and I never got to see Van Halen with Roth, was the Eat Him a Smile show. And great concert, phenomenal show. My second show was the 5150 tour. Another two. And they're both in my top five all-time concerts.
With that, we come to the end of episode one of our interview with Steve Rosen, the author of Tone Chaser, his amazing career-long and almost lifelong relationship with Eddie Van Halen. Be sure to tune into episode two, which starts up with the Sammy Hagar era and goes beyond that up until Eddie's death. We'll see you on the next episode. You've been listening to Behind the Curtain, a What's Hot in the Strip Clubs podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network. Check us out on all major streaming platforms or at our website, www.whatshotitsc.com.
Thanks for listening to What's Hot in the Strip Clubs with Danny Myers and Alon Fong, presented by Panda and Strip Joints Music. You can find us on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.